Inside a crowded screened front porch for a cottage-style house were four uniformed officers, two EMT workers, and a kid who was not much older than 18. Friends, Phoenicians, listeners, lend me your ear. How you doing? This is Keith Tyler bringing you... That was horrible. Bringing you the Mystery Hour here on Sun Sounds of Arizona. All right, I gave it a good shot. Thank you so much for joining me. Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine and David Zeltzerman bring us our first story, and it's called The Way Some Die. It's not my fault. My partner, Joe Sullivan, was sulking, mostly because he was once again missing the night's Red Sox game, and I guess to some small degree that I was paying the price for his sins. If he thought I was going to say anything to absolve him of his guilt over his actions causing us to be moved from the day shift to the 5 to 1 a.m. shift, he was nuts. Without bothering to look at him, I continued to muddle my way through the paperwork for an arrest made earlier that evening for a string of home burglaries. Joe, not to be deterred, acted as his own straight man, asking me if I knew whose fault it really was for him being suspended for 2 weeks and then us being put on this lousy shift once he was reinstated. Again, I ignored him, and he answered anyway, saying it was the Bruins' fault. Well, that was progress. At least he was no longer blaming the FBI agent whose jaw he busted. Joe, who in his younger days was the pride of South Boston, where he boxed as an amateur under the name Red Sullivan, no longer had any visible red hair, nor would he be able to box as a middleweight, but he still had a lightning-fast right cross. He was lucky the agent had declined to press charges, no doubt embarrassed over the fact that Joe had laid him out so quickly, especially after the agent had needled Joe from the moment we were assigned to assist him in the theft of a biohazard material from MIT. Even with Joe's newfound self-reflection, I still tried to ignore him. While I didn't bother to look at him, we'd been partners long enough that I knew he had stopped sulking and now was brooding silently. This only lasted a minute. "The Bruins had a historically great season," he said, more as a challenge than a statement of fact. I shifted my gaze just enough to see that he had his thick jaw jutted out, as if he were waiting for me to argue with him. "They won more games in the regular season than any team ever has. This was their year to win the Stanley Cup. And then what happens? They lose in the first round, on a fluke overtime goal." "It was almost 2 weeks later that you punched out the FBI agent," I said, regretting instantly that I gave him any satisfaction. "Well, yeah, that's true," Joe said, trying to hide that he was pleased with himself for finally getting a response out of me. I'd been stonewalling him ever since we'd been put on this shift, only talking to him when it was needed for the job. He continued, saying, "But it put me in a rotten mood, for I just couldn't get out of it. And then that jerk FBI agent finding out I was a boxer and calling me Palooka Joe one too many times. Steve, I saw red. Honest to God, I didn't even realize I'd punched him until I saw him flat on his back. But come on, what are you so upset about? You got a nice, sweet wife to go home to. All I got to look forward to are Sox games, and those have been taken away by this rotten shift." You know, Mindy works as a high school teacher. She's out of bed by 6 and not home until after 4. So that means I don't see her. "Well, you see her on weekends, and school's out soon, so you'll be seeing her then. In the meantime, you know what they say about absence making the heart grow fonder." I felt bone tired right then. The exhaustion hit me suddenly, and I didn't feel like I had the strength to even peck away anymore on the keyboard. "I should retire," I said. "I should just get the paperwork in and be done with this." You've been saying that ever since you got your 20 years in. We both know you're not going anywhere till you get your 30 years. A phone call came in that we had a dead body in East Cambridge. The thought of that made me even more tired. The address we were sent to was in what used to be a blue-collar neighborhood in East Cambridge, but that was well in the past. While the houses were small and built in the 1800s and not much to look at, these days they were worth a small fortune, more anyway than I'd ever be able to afford. Inside a crowded screen front porch for a cottage-style house were four uniformed officers, two EMT workers, and a kid who was not much older than 18. The kid looked sick to his stomach as he told us how he had discovered the body. The story he stammered out was that he was there to deliver a pizza, and when no one answered the doorbell, he tried the door, found it unlocked, and soon after found a man dead at the bottom of the staircase leading to the second floor. One of the EMT workers confirmed that the man inside was indeed dead and offered her opinion that the cause of death was blunt force trauma to the head. "It could have happened from the fall down the staircase," she conceded unconvincingly. "How about you wait here with these officers?" I told the kid. Three of the officers were young, and while I vaguely remember seeing them around the precinct, I didn't know them. The fourth I knew. An old-timer named Lenny Goldman. I asked him to lead Joe and me to the dead body. He told us the house was empty other than the deceased. Then he took us inside and led us to a cramped front room that was dominated by two badly worn cloth recliners that faced a TV set mounted on the wall. Past the chairs lay a body stretched out on his stomach by a wooden staircase. He looked to be in his 70s and had a pair of brown corduroy pants and a Dwight Evans Red Sox jersey, which he must have had for over 30 years, given how long Evans had last played for the Sox. I guessed his height at 5'8". He looked scrawny but couldn't have weighed more than a 140. And given the way the Red Sox jersey draped over him, he made me think of a scarecrow who had been knocked over. I moved closer. The man's neck didn't look broken, and there was no blood pooled on the wooden floor. More as an observation, I asked, "Could someone fall down that staircase and land like this?" Goldman said, "Maybe." Joe didn't argue with him, but his expression showed that he didn't think it was likely. "Do you know his name?" I asked.
Walter Albert. He's lived here since I've been on the force."
I slipped a pair of latex gloves on. The little hair he had was white and cut close to the scalp. A groan escaped from me as I lowered myself onto my heel so I could probe his skull. I didn't find any open wounds, only a softness in the area on the right side of his skull. I groaned again as I stood up, my knees feeling creaky and ancient. Joe asked Goldman,
What do you think of the kid's story?"
"Solid. My partner and I were driving down the street when we saw the kid entering the house and thought maybe he shouldn't be, so we followed him inside. He didn't have time for any mischief."
Joe grunted at that.
"You called this in?"
he said.
"Yep, I also called in for backup. The other two officers keeping the kid company on the porch, Steve Hicks and Paul Hayes, searched the exterior, but didn't find anything unusual."
The latex gloves Joe forced over his beefy hands looked like they were going to burst apart, but they miraculously held together. Even though he was 10 years younger than me, Joe had far creakier knees, and he gritted his teeth and grimaced as he lowered himself onto one knee. Gingerly, he tilted Albert to one side so he could search his pants pocket. Then he tilted him onto his other side so he could search the other pocket. He didn't find anything, and that seemed to confirm whatever it was he was thinking. I asked him what he had been looking for. Joe grimaced some more as he struggled back onto his feet.
"I was seeing if he had a cigar stub tucked away in there. He doesn't."
The house reeked of cigar smoke. I turned back to look at the recliners. There was a small wooden table between them, and that's where an ashtray should have been if Albert had been a cigar smoker. But there wasn't one. Joe joined me as I walked over to the recliner so I could get the table a closer look. There was no dust or cigar ash on the table, as it had been wiped clean. But I could make out a faint square outline of what must have been a heavy glass ashtray that had sat on the table for decades. In my mind's eye, I could see clearly what must have happened. Walter Albert had a guest over, and the two of them were sitting in the recliner smoking cigars and watching the Sox game. A pizza was ordered. Then something happened to cause tempers to flare, and the family member, or friend, or whoever it was, grabbed the ashtray and struck Albert with it, killing him. The killer then dragged Albert to the staircase to make his death look like an accident, and then cleaned up the ashes and cigar butts that must have ended up all over the room. He must have also taken the ashtray with him when he fled. I thought about Albert's weight and decided the killer could have also been a woman strong enough to drag 140 pounds. I also thought that while the murder might have been done in the heat of the moment, the killer could have had darker motives, or a financial one. "This is a homicide," I said. Joe agreed. "I wonder if the medical examiner will be able to tell us whether he's been a cigar smoker at the time of his death." His eyes grew distant, and he gave the matter some more thought. "If I had to guess, more than one cigar had been smoked in here recently." "I'll call this in," I said. "I'm going to give the upstairs a look and see what I can find. Will you handle things down here?"
"Yeah, sure thing, Steve." The glint in Joe's eyes told me he had something in mind, but I didn't bother asking what it was, since I already had a good idea, namely that he was claiming the pizza the kid had delivered to the house as evidence. At least until he sent the kid away. Before heading upstairs, I gave the first floor rooms a quick walkthrough. Everything was clean and orderly. The kitchen looked like it had been last remodeled in the 70s, and same with the bathroom. Some of the furniture might have been bought over the last 40 years, but at least half of it looked like it had been passed on to Albert from his parents or maybe his in-laws if he had been married. I checked the trash cans in the kitchen and bathroom to see if anyone had recently deposited cigar butts or ashes into them, and nobody had. My guess was the cigar ashes were vacuumed up by the vacuum cleaner I'd found in a closet. Maybe we'd get lucky and find prints on them. I nodded bleakly at Walter Albert's dead body as I stepped past him and headed upstairs, making a solemn promise that I'd find his killer. The two bedrooms upstairs were as neat and orderly as the rooms downstairs, the bathroom also looking like it hadn't been updated since the 70s. As much as the downstairs furniture, the dresser and clothes bureau in the master bedroom looked old, as if it had been bought from a second-hand store years ago or had been passed on to Albert. There was a wedding photo on the dresser, along with three other framed photos of his wife that were taken over different decades. There were no photos of any children. I called the precinct and asked the desk sergeant to send over a crime scene team and contact the state's medical examiner office in Boston. "So we have a murder?" the sergeant said, sounding a bit skeptical, which was understandable since we usually have at most one murder a year in Cambridge, and many years none at all. And this was going on our third, and it was only June. I told him there was no doubt this was a homicide made to look like an accident, and then I had him transfer me to the detective's desk. A freshly minted detective by the name of Sarah Crane picked up. It had been a slow night for her, but when I told her what I wanted and why, she perked right up and promised she'd call me as soon as she found the information. It didn't take me long to find a box tucked away in the closet that held papers that Walter Albert considered important enough to store. There was a death certificate for his wife, who had died 7 years earlier, a deed for the house,
his retirement paperwork after working 40 years at the U.S. Postal Service, and his will, which left his property to be divided equally between Bruce Albert and Paul Albert. According to a home purchase agreement that had been also stored away, Albert had bought the house in 1981 for $38,400. Even though now it would most likely be a teardown, his heirs would be able to get at least $800,000 for it. If an agreement had led to Albert's death, $400,000 would be more than enough of an inducement to let that argument get out of hand. My phone rang. It was Sarah calling me back to tell me what I pretty much already knew, that Walter Albert had two sons. Bruce Albert lived in Somerville and Paul Albert in Medford. Both cities were less than 20 minutes' drive from East Cambridge. She told me she'd text me their address, and true to her word, shortly after I got off the phone with her, the texts arrived. I headed back downstairs again, stepped past the late Walter Albert. A quick look out the window showed that the porch was empty of patrolmen and EMT workers, as well as the pizza delivery kid. As expected, I found Joe sitting in the kitchen munching on a slice of pizza, with another slice already missing. "A sausage on one half, olive on the other," Joe said. I took photos of it before digging in, and since it actually is evidence that Albert had company over since he had it ordered it only for himself, he wouldn't have had to have the toppings separated like that. The pizza's not going to last to try, so help yourself. It's no Giovanni's, but it's not bad. I passed on the pizza, swallowing back the comment that he was being awfully generous with a pizza that he had pilfered from a kid. Instead, I told him that we needed to get the vacuum cleaner, broom, and dustbin in the kitchen closet dusted for prints. Then I asked him what happened to the patrolman. "I'm having them be useful by canvassing the neighborhood to see if anyone saw anything." There was a glint in Joe's eyes that showed there was more to it than that, but I let it drop. The killer was going to be one of Albert's sons, so Joe could go down whatever rabbit hole he wanted so long as I didn't get dragged down with him. I told him what I found in the bedroom and how the house was going to Albert's two sons, both of them whom lived locally. "I'm going to call on them and let them know what happened to their dad," I said. "I'd like to see if I can figure out which of them is genuinely surprised by the news. How about you wait here for the medical examiner and forensics team?" "Oh, I'd be happy to." Of course he would. He had an extra-large pizza to polish off. But there was something else. He had something in the works that he thought would lead to the murderer. Well, I didn't bother asking him about it. During all the years we'd been partners, this wasn't the first time he'd gone off on a wild goose chase. While I didn't want to get petty about it, I couldn't help myself. Ever since we were exiled to the night shift, I found myself wanting to spend whatever time on the job I could, not having to see or hear him. I could have called the two brothers and arranged for us to meet together, but I wanted to talk to each of them separately, so I drove to Bruce Albert's address first, which turned out to be an apartment in a three-family home. I heard a TV set on in Albert's apartment, and after knocking and getting no answer, I knocked louder and announced myself as a Cambridge police detective. It took another minute after that before Albert opened the door wearing a badly stained T-shirt and dirty khakis. He looked pretty much how I would have imagined a 50-year-old version of Walter Albert, except shabbier and heavier. From the bleary-eyed look he gave me and the stench of alcohol on his breath, he'd been drinking. I was pretty sure I'd also picked up a whiff of cigar smoke. "Is this about my dad?" he asked, his voice slurred enough to show he was drunk. "Why would you ask that?" "Because you're a Cambridge cop, and my dad lives in Cambridge. What happened to him?" "I think it would be better if we talked inside." His eyes darkened with belligerence as he looked like every other drunk guy at a bar who was about to throw the first punch. "How about you tell me right now?" he said. "It's either going to be in your apartment or at the precinct. Your choice." The moment of violence passed. He stepped aside to let me enter a depressingly shabby room that had a card table and folding chair for eating and a ratty sofa in front of a wall-mounted TV. On the floor next to the sofa was a half-full fifth of rye whiskey and an empty glass. It wasn't hard to guess that Bruce Albert lived alone and had fallen on hard times. I let him take the sofa, which looked like something he'd picked up off a street on trash day, and grabbed the folding chair and moved it so we could talk, figuring there was less chance of picking up lice or bedbugs from it. Albert left the rye bottle and glass on the floor and demanded to know what happened to his dad. "We found your father dead inside his house," I said.
"I see," he said without any change in expression. "How'd he die?"
"Well, it looks like an accident. He fell down the stairs and hit his head." He smiled bitterly at that.
"When we were kids, he used to yell at me and Paul about running down the stairs, telling me we'd trip and break our necks."
"It doesn't seem as if you were close to your father."
"Well, that's an understatement."
His eyes narrowed and his mouth pinched into an angry circle as his belligerence made a return.
"Why are you asking about my relationship with my dad if he died in an accident?" he demanded.
"Oh, I only made an observation," I said. "But until we get the autopsy report and are able to officially mark your father's death as accidental, I need to follow procedure, which includes asking you questions."
"What if I don't want to answer them?"
"That's your right, although I don't see why you wouldn't unless we're wrong about your father's death being accidental." He made a face as if he'd swallowed sour milk. Or maybe these days any type of milk would cause him to make a face.
"All right, go ahead, ask away."
"Did you see him tonight?"
"Nope."
"When was the last time you did see him?" He gave that some thought.
My mom died 7 years ago. I saw him at the funeral and probably a couple of times after that, but not for at least 5 years.
He showed a bitter smile.
"What a year I've had. I lost my job, got divorced, and now I'm an orphan. If I had a dog that just died, I'd be living the life of a cliched country song."
Except he was about to inherit at least $400,000, so life wasn't about to be all that pitiful for him, unless he ended up spending the rest of it in prison for first-degree murder. I asked, "What caused the bad blood between you and your dad?" He made his sour milk face again.
We just never got along. After my mom passed away, I had no reason to see him, and I doubt he minded that."
"Where were you tonight?"
"Mostly home."
He glanced at the bottle by his feet, but thought better of pouring himself another shot.
"I went out to a neighborhood spot, but after shelling out $10 for a watered-down whiskey, I decided that when I drink alone, I'd rather be by myself."
He said the last part as a joke, referencing the George Thorogood song, but the smile he attempted cracked badly. "Did you pay by credit card?"
"Cash."
Of course he had. I asked, "Do you smoke cigars?"
"No. Why?"
"Well, your father's house smelled of cigar smoke. I can smell cigar smoke on you." His belligerence once again briefly flashed in his eyes before his eyes dulled back to the color of pewter. His tone was petulant as he said,
"How many times do I have to tell you that I haven't been at that house in years? The bar I went to isn't all that strict about following the state's anti-smoking laws, and someone must have lit up. I didn't realize it, but if you say I smell like cigars, that must be why."
I wasn't going to get anywhere pushing the matter, and instead I had him tell me the name of the scofflaw establishment he had supposedly gone to that night. And after several attempts, I also got him to narrow down the time when he was there, which, if true, didn't preclude him from having earlier murdered his father. Anyone there who'd remember you?"
"The woman tending the bar might. She was about 35, red hair, skinny but cute."
another flare-up of his belligerence, then, "But that sweetheart made a point of not looking at me, acting as if I was invisible even when she bought me my drink."
The dinginess of Bruce Albert and his apartment was getting to me. There was nothing I could say to make him crack and confess. If he was the killer, I was only going to get him through methodical police work, such as finding a witness who saw him in East Cambridge or finding him on traffic cam video. Still, there was one question I wanted to see his reaction to. "Did you know your father's will left his estate entirely to you and Brother Paul?" He looked at me as if I were making a bad joke.
"You're not kidding me, right? You saw his will?"
"There was a copy stored away in his bedroom."
He bit his thumbnail as he tried and failed to suppress a smile.
"I had no idea," he said. "My mom, when she was dying, must have made him promise to do that. Otherwise, I'm sure he would have left it all to Paul."
"Did your brother have a good relationship with your father?"
"I don't think so. He probably feels the same as I do. But he's still married and has 3 kids, so he tries to play the part of the dutiful son for his family's sake."
He stopped trying to fight back his smile and instead flashed me a grin.
"Paul must have been sure he'd get the house. He's going to be disappointed when he finds out he has to share it with me."
"Do you know if he goes to your father's house at times to smoke cigars and watch the Red Sox?"
"Paul and I don't talk often. You'll have to ask him that."
I pushed myself to my feet. Before Albert knew what I was up to, I took out my phone and snapped a photo of him.
"You know, routine procedure," I explained. "I'm going to visit your brother Paul now, and I'm going to ask you not to contact him until I have a chance to talk with him. If you do, I'll find out about it, and I'll be arresting you for interfering with police investigations."
If he had any doubts earlier, he knew now that my coming to see him and questioning him was far beyond normal procedure. After leaving his apartment, I went to the bar and he claimed he had gone to that night. There was no doorman to show Albert's picture to, but there was a redhead working the bar. The place was a dive. It was also loud and crowded. I could smell stale beer and worse, but no whiff of cigar smoke. When I approached the redhead working the bar, she gave me a quick glance before hurrying off and busying herself at the other end of it, as if she hadn't seen me. She must have guessed I was a cop. I removed any doubts by holding up my badge. She reluctantly came over, and I showed her Bruce Albert's photo and asked if she'd seen him that night. She shook her head and told me she didn't remember him. "He claims you served him a shot of whiskey around 9.
"It's possible."
She squinted again at the photo and made a shrugging gesture with her eyebrows.
"He's not all that memorable."
"I'm not looking to find your fine establishment. I'm a Cambridge detective, and I couldn't even if I wanted to, but it would help my investigation to know whether anyone lit up a cigar earlier." Her expression grew more cautious as she told me she couldn't remember anyone doing something like that, which is what she would have told me regardless of whether anyone had smoked or not. So that was it. I wasn't going to find out if the whiff of cigar smoke I picked up from Albert came from this bar or his father's home, and if she couldn't remember him, nobody else there was going to. It was possible he'd gone there like he said, and it was also possible that he had just stuck his head in to see who was working the bar to use as an alibi. Medford bordered Somerville, and Paul Albert's address was less than 2 miles away. At that time of night, it only took me 5 minutes to drive to his modest colonial home on what felt like a quiet residential street. There was no driveway, but I was able to park on the street 2 houses away. When I rang the doorbell, a timid-looking middle-aged woman answered. I identified myself, and she quickly went from timid to scared.
"Is Paul in trouble?" she asked.
"You're his wife?" She nodded, looking almost too afraid to speak. "Your husband's not accused of anything, but I need to speak to him. Is he home?"
She shook her head. I checked my watch and was surprised to see it was only 9:45. It felt so much later than that. I asked, "When do you expect him home?" She looked even more scared than before as she told me she was sure he'd be back soon.
Sometimes Paul pops off for a drink or two after work. Can you tell me what this is about?"
"It would be better if I talked to your husband directly." I handed her a card with my name and cell phone number. "Have him call me when he gets home. If I don't hear back, I'll drop by again later tonight. Is this usual for him?" I could see the calculation in her eyes on whether to lie to me, but she probably wasn't sure which answer would be better for her and her husband, so grudgingly she told me the truth, which was that most nights he was home by 7. I had her give me her husband's cell phone number. I was about to turn away from her and head back to my car, but decided to ask her the question I'd been debating with myself about since finding out that her husband wasn't home. Yeah, she'd be able to warn him about it, but I wanted to see her reaction. "Does he ever stop off to see his father on the way home?" That startled her enough that she involuntarily took half a step back into her home. "Walter's house is in the opposite direction," she stumbled out. That didn't really answer my question, at least not directly. I asked her again to have her husband call me when he got home. I waited until I was in my car to try calling Albert, and my call went straight to his voicemail. After that, I found a pub a few blocks away where the kitchen was still open, and I could order a burger and a beer. When the waitress brought over my beer, she gave me a concerned look, saying, "Hon, what's troubling you?" "I'm trying to figure out which of two brothers killed their father for the inheritance."
"You kidding, right?"
"Yeah, don't remind me. It's just one of those nights." She looked relieved, although as she was walking away, she glanced over her shoulder at me as if she weren't quite sure I had been kidding. I sat back and pondered the questions at hand, because as much as I liked Bruce Albert for the murder, his brother disappearing for the night threw a monkey wrench into my convictions. There were also other factors. Bruce Albert could certainly use the money. He could have been drinking earlier to steal himself for the visit he knew was coming, or it could have been just that he did most nights. His story about stopping off at the bar for a drink seemed like a lie, but if he were going to lie about that, why not give me a time that would have made it impossible for him to have killed his father? Aside from his belligerence, he wasn't all that memorable, and I could believe the bartender serving him a drink and not noticing him enough to remember it. He also seemed genuinely surprised to hear he was inheriting anything from his father, but alcohol can make almost anyone a convincing liar. And then there was his brother's unexplained absence. And more than that, it was his wife not directly answering my question about whether her husband ever visited his father after work. She suspected something, but there wasn't a chance in hell I'd ever get it out of her. I tried to imagine how it might have been Paul Albert. Homes in Medford aren't as ridiculously expensive as they are in Cambridge, but they're still expensive, even the modest one that Albert was living in. Whether he was paying rent or a mortgage, it was going to be a big chunk of money each month, which would feel even bigger with 3 kids. So what happened? Did he arrange to come over to his father's house to watch a Sox game, smoke cigars, and eat pizza? Maybe he asked for a loan, got turned down, and that led to heated arguments that turned violent. It didn't matter, at least as far as I was concerned, unless we cracked the case tonight. Tomorrow morning, the precinct captain would be assigning it to detectives on the day shift, and I'd be stuck on the night shift with Joe for the foreseeable future, handling the burglaries and other assorted cases that come in then. My cell phone rang. I was surprised that Paul Albert was calling me, as I was sure I would have to chase him down, and I couldn't help frowning when the caller ID showed it was Joe.
I answered the call, and Joe told me he had the murderer in Interrogation Room B. My frown deepened as I asked him which brother was the killer.
Neither. How long will it take you to get back to the precinct?
Well, I don't know. I'm in Medford, waiting on a burger.
Oh, by all means, take your time. Just because I've got the murderer on ice, in any minute now he might wise up and ask for a lawyer. Don't let that interfere with your dinner plans.
I'd known Joe to go off half-cocked before. Maybe he had the killer, maybe he didn't. Without much enthusiasm, I asked, "All right, what do you have?"
"Enough. If you get your butt back here, we get a confession out of him and wrap this up tonight."
If Joe had anything solid, he would have told me. He was betting on a hunch. I couldn't help groaning. It was already past 10, which meant I had little chance of finding an open restaurant, and if I passed up this burger, the only food I'd be getting that night would be a microwaved burrito from an all-night convenience store. I resigned myself to the situation and told him I'd be back in the precinct in 10 minutes.
"Okay, meet me up at the coffee machine."
He hung up before I could change my mind. I waved the waitress over and settled up my bill, asking her to give my meal to a needy soul when it was ready. 8 minutes later, I was back at the precinct, and a minute after that I spotted Joe by the coffee machine. He showed me a look that most people would take as indigestion, but we'd been partners long enough that I knew it was as close to a tender smile as he could manufacture. Joe first made sure no one was in eavesdropping range, then, keeping his voice to a low rumble, he said,
"I know I haven't been your favorite guy since I've gotten us banished to this shift. The last few days, it's been darned obvious that you can barely stomach having me around. But, Steve, we've been partners for a lot of years, and I know in my heart we've been friends also. All I ask is that you give me a chance."
"I'm trying," I said, and I meant it. I even found myself regretting the animosity that had been building up inside me just because he had something any other hothead would do. "What do you got?" He showed me a complete deadpan as he said,
"The murder weapon."
"No kidding?"
"No kidding. I also got a deal from the captain that if we wrap this up tonight, we can get moved back to our normal shift."
"You called him at home?" I said, whistling softly and shaking my head in admiration. "Whew, I'm impressed."
"As well you should be."
He took one of the coffees and handed me the other, telling me it was for the perp. As we made our way to his desk, he told me that the perp's name was Doug Hensley, and that he lived on the same street as Walter Albert. On his desk, wrapped up in a plastic evidence bag, was a thick glass ashtray that could put a dent in anyone's head. Joe handed me a folded sheet of paper and grabbed the ashtray for himself. I unfolded the paper and saw that it was a search warrant that we had used months ago. Joe winked at me.
"Watch the video feed, and when I signal you, come in with that and hand it to me."
I didn't argue with him. When we got to the interrogation room, Joe took the coffee from me and went inside while I sat down and watched over a monitor what was happening in the room. Doug Hensley was a large, grizzled man in his late 50s who sat scowling with his heavy arms crossed over his chest. I couldn't imagine Joe or anyone else getting him to spill anything, let alone confess to a murder. Joe took the seat across from Henley, placed the ashtray in front of him, and pushed one of the coffees halfway across the table. Hensley reluctantly uncrossed his arms so he could take the coffee. Joe proceeded to stare at Hensley. After several minutes of this, Hensley cracked enough to lower his gaze at his now empty coffee mug.
"You're not a dummy, I'll give you that," Joe said. "You did a first-class job cleaning up Albert's living room after scattering cigar ashes when you smashed in his head, and you were smart enough to wipe off your prints off of the ashtray. It was also smart of you to toss it in the garbage can in the opposite direction from Albert's house to your own." It was just bad luck on your part that a neighbor across the street from the Morrisons saw you doing it.
Whoever thought they saw me is mistaken,
Hensley conceded to Utter, his scowl remaining firmly in place.
I was home all night.
Watching the Sox and smoking a cigar.
Yeah, until you dragged me down here.
That was also smart. Lighten up another cigar at home to explain why you smelled like cigars if we came knocking on your door. Let me tell you where you messed up. As careful as you were cleaning off your prints from the ashtray and vacuum you used, you made two fatal mistakes. One, you left a print on the garbage can lid. And two, you missed some of the cigar ash that our crime scene team collected between the cushions in one of the recliners.
Joe reached into his pocket and pulled out a small plastic evidence bag that might have held cigar ash, or it could have been dirt.
Thanks to the eyewitness account and the fact that you smoke cigars, my partner is getting a judge to sign a search warrant. Once he gets that, we'll be fingerprinting you and to test against what we've got off the garbage can lid. And what will be even more damning, having forensics run a very expensive test to see if this cigar ash is the same brand we find in your home.
I know you brought the cigars over to Albert since there were none found in his house. There was a subtle change in Henley's expression. I saw it, and I was sure Joe saw it also.
I might have thrown something away in the garbage can early in the day, Hensley said,
but he no longer sounded like someone who was going to stonewall us to the end of time. Instead, there was a defeated tone in his voice. Joe sat quietly for several minutes after that before signaling me. I played my part, walking into the interrogation room and handing Joe the old expired search warrant.
Judge Kramer didn't appreciate being woken up, I said, but he had no problem signing the warrant once I outlined to him our evidence. I then continued to play my part as I took the seat next to Joe and fixed a hard stare on Hensley. Joe made a show of reading the bogus search warrant. Then he mustered what looked like genuine sympathy toward Hensley. Maybe it was.
Well, we'll be booking you now, he said, after we get your fingerprints matched and this cigar ash tested with what we find in your house. It's over. But if I had to guess, this was done in the heat of the moment over something really stupid, which would make it involuntary manslaughter. And if that's the way it works out, you'd have a chance of life again in 4 to 6 years, as long as you cooperate and behave yourself. What happened? A dumb argument that got out of hand?
Hensley grimaced as if he had a bad toothache.
A bet, he said.
Over what?
Over whether a player was going to strike out. Hensley's tone turned defiant as he added,
I won the bet, a 3-2 count, and the ball was clearly off the plate, but the jackass umpire rung him up anyway.
Albert kept needling you about that bet, didn't he?
Hensley nodded glumly.
Yeah, I didn't realize what I did until after it happened, he said.
Joe pushed toward Hensley a pad of paper that he had brought earlier into the room and handed him a pen. Write it up, and I'll do my best to make sure that the district attorney charges this as involuntary manslaughter. Half an hour later, we had signed confession. By 1 a.m., we were having celebratory beers at a restaurant in Boston's North End that kept their kitchen open until last call, and I was able to order a plate of linguine and meatballs. Minutes after we had booked Hensley, I got a call back from Paul Albert, and I filled him in about his father. I also left a message with Bruce Albert on what we found. I told Joe, you got lucky he bought your bluff about being able to identify the brand of cigars from ashes. Joe, in high spirits, grinned at me.
I wasn't just bluffing about that. There were no usable fingerprints on the garbage can, and nobody saw Hensley toss the ashtray. But Steve, you, with your logical thinking, focused right away on what made sense to you, namely that the likely perp was one of the two guys inheriting a lot of money. Me? I understand guys like Albert and Hensley. And my gut, from the start, was that this was just a stupid death. And so I gave special instructions from the canvas. First, be on the lookout for anyone smelling like cigars, and second, ask about Albert and who in the neighborhood he was chummy with.
What if it had been someone from outside the neighborhood?
Well, then it would have been a problem, Joe admitted. But I wouldn't have been a problem for long. First thing in the morning, the captain would have reassigned the homicide to detectives working the day shift.
The waitress came over with two more beers and my food. Joe emptied half of his glass before telling me that after they found the ashtray, he knew the perp lived in the neighborhood.
If it was someone from outside, he wouldn't have been walking around looking for a place to toss a murder weapon. He would have gotten in his car and driven as far away as he could.
That was when I called the captain and made my deal.
I might have also told him that if we didn't get a signed confession that night, the case wasn't going to get solved. I'll admit I got lucky when one of the patrolmen, Lenny Goldman, called to tell me that a neighbor pointed him out to Hensley.
I could have left it alone, and I probably should have. Maybe I was a little peeved that Joe had figured everything out before I as much as had a clue, or maybe there was still some resentment over the weeks I'd spent on the night shift. But I commented how if the FBI agent had hit his head differently on the sidewalk, Joe would have found himself in the same boat as Hensley was in now. Joe's eyes dulled first, then his grin, as he considered that.
"As I told you before, I understand guys like Albert and Hensley," he said.
Okie doke. I'm in the Ellery Queen Mystery Magazine now. This is a story written by Minnesota author Joseph Goodrich, and it's called Two Men Discuss Murder on a Rainy Night Near Patchen Place.
Thumbnail, right hand?
Yes.
Exceptionally long. Drug dealer?
Eh, maybe.
Left hand?
Yes.
Fingertips?
Yes.
Calluses? Guitar player?
Maybe.
Why him?
Didn't they tell you?
No.
It's okay. The less you know, the better.
I can't help but wonder.
Don't worry. You won't after a while.
Oh, yes, I will, no matter what you say.
I know too much.
His name is Kenneth. He draws. He paints. His health is not good. He has a wife, and her name is Miriam. He has two kids and the kind of luck that only turns bad. He'll be coming along 6th Avenue any moment now.
There he is.
Right on time. What now?
We wait.
We wait?
We wait.
But not for long.
Jeez, this kid. Ain't one thing, it's another. Patience is a lesson.
When to move.
When not to move. And what to do when it's over.
All right, let's go.
Stinking rain.
And now Seattle writer. Arendse Lund brings us a short story called A Page Out of Her Own Book. We got a requested... Read this one. The gold still shimmered on the page 8 centuries after its meticulous application by a medieval monk who had spent years in a scriptorium bowed over the little manuscript. Lily appreciated his dedication. The manuscript, oh, was stunning. A large initial sat at the top left of the folio, with pen flourishes curling out and trailing down alongside the text. She ran a single finger in the margin, careful to avoid touching any of the ink. The gold leaf had only been applied to the capital R that opened the passage, R for Rex. Lily didn't know Latin, but she knew that word. Inside the initial, no bigger than her fingernail, perched a king on his throne, a Richard perhaps, or maybe an Edward. She couldn't read the black-letter script. She had always been more interested in modern texts than medieval ones in her college classes. No matter. As they say, the right professor made all the difference. His enthusiasm for manuscripts had been infectious, and now here Lily was making a career out of them. All she needed was the page with its bright initial. Someone was always willing to pay for a slice of history to hang on their wall, even more so if it was illuminated. If she picked the right manuscript, something not too ostentatious, not too studied, then there's a chance her actions wouldn't be discovered for years to come. There was also a certain fission when finding the right target. Who said bookworms couldn't be thrill-seekers? Everywhere she went, there were archives with treasures waiting to be unearthed, illuminated manuscripts shimmering with gold, maps with monsters patrolling the seas, and with the right buyer, her time and efforts were more than compensated. People were happy to overlook the sale of single-sheet manuscript pages, pieces clearly shorn from context, all for that pretty picture framed for display. That was more than fine with Lucy. When the archivist looked the other way, Lily shook the X-Acto knife out of her sleeve and began to cut. And now back to the Alfred Hitchcock magazine. The Story That Won is my next read. You may recall that the magazine publishes a picture and asks the readers to write a short story about it. This one comes from Jane Wyant of Round Hill, Virginia. The picture is a brick wall. Part of it is got the mortar in it. The right third has the mortar, looks like it's chipped out. You can see a little bit of the ground. And on the ground, resting on the ground, in leaning against the wall, is a trumpet, of all things. The bell's to the right, the mouthpiece is to the left. The story is called Oompa Oompa. Oompa music mixed with crowd noise as Nick picked a wedgie from his later hosen he'd had to wear. His dad bod was 25 years removed from his marching band days, but he liked to think he was still kind of in shape and capable of running in a brewery's competition, Bavarian Pac-Man. Contestants had to collect 12 coasters from a corn maze without being tagged by any of the four teenage boys hired by the brewery as chasers. Nick suspected they all ran track. No one had yet claimed the prize of 50 cases of beer, but Nick had a secret weapon. A few hundred people in assorted golden doodles watched from the hill overlooking the maze, drinking and cheering. A polka band was on hand for the Oktoberfest weekend. They sat on a small stage and had a perfect view of the maze and the chase. With a signal, Nick was off. He'd only gone a few hundred paces when he heard four rising quarter notes on the trumpet. He stopped and crouched as a teen raced by on a perpendicular path and didn't notice him. A series of triplets and Nick turned left at a T intersection. The competition was over in less than 5 minutes. Very few people noted the improvisation of Mark, the trumpet player. instead asking each other how Nick had done it.
Later that night, Mark and Nick toasted their perfect crime with free beer and memories of band camp.
Now I'll play the music. This is Keith Dollar saying thank you so much for tuning into the Mystery Hour here on Sun Sounds of Arizona. We do very much appreciate it. Tune in again next time, if you would, please. Make sure your I love yous are in order. Thanks. So long.